Glasgow is a city divided, cut in half by one lethal weapon, the blade.
Knife crimes and razor gangs have been a presence on the streets of Glasgow for nearly 200 years.
There are more scarred faces in Glasgow than anywhere else in Britain. In 2002, the World Health Organization declared Scotland as one of the bloodiest nations in the Western world, and Glasgow, the murder capital of Europe.
The roots of this violence lie in Glasgow's back streets and becomes most volatile when the city's two football clubs, Celtic and Rangers, clash.
A brutal razor attack in the 1920s shines light on this rivalry, which runs far deeper than football.
Almost 80 years later, in 2010, another victim is cut down. This time butchered with a sword after an argument escalates out of control.
We're going to look at two savage attacks which typify the city's street violence, and we'll investigate the cause and effect of the split that still divides Glasgow to this day.
In the 1920s, Glasgow was the most overcrowded city in Britain, with more street gangs than anywhere else. There were six times more gangs in Glasgow than even London. It was also one of Britain's poorest cities.
Glasgow became the corpse of an industrial city, devoid of the spirit of industry. And in the poorest areas, the razor gangs prospered. And the city's hard man mentality became firmly entrenched.
To find out what effect this mindset had upon the city, I'm going to meet historian Douglas Skelton.
What's the history of the gang culture here? And when did it start?
Ever since they started building what would become the slums, the gangs would have formed. There were gangs that would come out of the slum areas, go to the centre of Glasgow and attack the travellers there. They would create a distraction and steal their luggage and pick their pockets. They would fight with each other. The earliest known gang is the Penny Mob from the 19th century. And they were called that because they paid a penny into a levy to help pay for fines. Coming into the 20th century, you started to see more gangs being formed with various colourful names, like the Redskins.
It's like pop bands, aren't they?
Well, they are, yes, except they got their name because their faces were slashed and took on a red hue, and they were very proud of this.
But now, the violence in Glasgow was about to get much worse. Into this deprived and competitive city came immigrants from Ireland. In the late 1800s, fleeing the second wave of the potato famine, they searched for work on Clydeside. They formed large Catholic neighbourhoods within the Protestant city. This new influx added unwelcome competition, creating resentment, hatred, and violence.
It would go back to the Irish potato famine. Now, that was the beginning of the sectarian strife in Glasgow because it was a Protestant city, as Scotland was a Protestant country, if you like, up until then. And a lot of these Catholics were coming in, and they just were viewed as less than human, very, very unfairly, because they were just coming over trying to survive.
Right.
They were seen as incomers who were going to steal their jobs, were going to steal their way of life. And it wasn't true, because in a lot of cases, they wouldn't get jobs because they were Catholic. So they started to cluster to themselves, as you would. They were looking for safety in numbers.
These are some of the areas where the Irish settled. Gorbals in the south, Carlton in the east, and Gangad, now Royston, just north of the Clyde. and these were Protestant areas, many of them in the west. One area which became a flashpoint bordering Catholic districts was called Bridgeton or Brigton. And this was home to an infamous Protestant gang, the Brigton Boys, soon to be known as the Billy Boys. They took their name from William of Orange, the Dutch-born king who in the 17th century annexed Northern Ireland and installed the Protestant church. The Billy Boys were devotees of King Billy.
Legend has it that the gang was formed in 1924 by a man who came from this street. His name was William Fullerton.
Apparently, when he was 18, he made the mistake of scoring a goal against the opposition, the Kent Star, a Catholic gang from Carlton. After the game, he was attacked by a Kent Star player wielding a hammer. He vowed to take revenge and formed a gang of 30 men.
Billy Fullerton, who formed them, according to the story, was beaten up by a gang of Catholics when he was in his late teens, and he decided that he would form his own gangs to... basically, anything they could do, he could do bloodier.
And here are the Brigton or Billy Boys, dressed in their marching regalia. And right here in the centre, with the big bass drum, that's their leader, Billy Fullerton himself.
I'm heading now to the centre of Billy Boy territory, known as the Toll, Brigton Cross, where the Billy Boys would all converge. This was their headquarters. They controlled this patch. Being Protestant, the Billy Boys saw themselves as patriotic defenders of the nation. Like mercenaries, they even loaned their services out to right-wing political movements. To learn more, I'm meeting up with historian Andrew Davis.
Now, I understand that the Billy Boys were employed politically as well by some of the local politicians.
That's right. There are reports of the Billy Boys disrupting left-wing meetings in Glasgow so that meetings of the Communist Party, for example, were vulnerable to being attacked.
So unlike other gangs, which very much stand outside of the law, the Billy Boys saw themselves as upholding the moral high ground.
They did, and they very much saw themselves as defending not just their fellow Protestants in the East End, but defending the Constitution.
The Protestant Billy Boys could be called upon for a show of muscle to repel any opposition. They were organised and dressed like an army.
This was a gang that almost saw themselves in a sort of military way, didn't they? They were quite well-disciplined, drilled. You paid money to be in this gang. What sort of things, how did they present themselves in that way?
Well, the gang was organised into sections with around 40 members, and apparently each section had its own leader, and that leader was then answerable, as it were, to the senior ranks of the gang, with Fullerton very much at the helm. So the gang's members paid subscription fees as part of their membership, and that money would be used to pay the members' fines when they were taken to court, but also to provide things like boots and clothing for members of the gang when they were released from jail.
So they would see themselves as being part of the establishment because the establishment was Protestant.
Because they came with flags and they came with song and they came with all those things that make up a regular army.
What had happened there was that when the Irish came over, it wasn't just Irish Catholics that came over, it was Irish Protestants as well. The Orange Walk was marched, or still is marched, to commemorate the Battle of the Boyne in July. And Billy Fullerton was quick to recognise that this was another strand that he could do for his Billy Boys. So he set up a flute band, and that's where they had the uniforms and the songs and the instruments.
My story from 2010 is about the Curran and the Malavin families. Zach Malavin, Andrew Curran. Two families supposedly attached to the same Maryhill Fleet Gang. This is Maryhill, where they hang out in the northwest of the city. But they're not alone. There's over 100 other gangs in this part of Glasgow, all in deprived areas where unemployment and drug use is high. I'm meeting up with journalist Stephen Wilkie, who has first-hand experience of the gangs in this neighbourhood.
There is no one gang for all of Maryhill. Maryhill's a huge area, but within that patch you'll have individual streets where you get 10, 15, 20 little gangs. They've got their own gang, named after the street usually, not like the English postcode gangs, and they're not organised in any way, there's no actual formal leader, it's just whoever's biggest and toughest on the day, or whoever's got the money to buy the carryout that day is the one that says what they do.
How long's it been going then?
Since the city was here. Since the city was here, there's always been somebody willing to tax their neighbour. Somebody willing to say, I run this street, or I run this building, or I run this high-rise. It's just people saying, this is my patch. Come into it at your peril. I'll come into your patch and I expect to get attacked, but I'll drag you back to my patch and my mob will kill you.
Yeah.
And it's kind of caveman-ish.
Once the violence was sectarian, but now it's mostly about drug turf, or in this case, plain old pride. The slightest slur upon another family can result in a bloodbath. This story is about the fallout between the Curran and the Malavim families. It was ignited by a juvenile joke.
One of the Malavins, or one of their associates, was very upset because somebody had nicked a bottle he had of booze, Buckfast vodka, one of these cheap drinks, and urinated into it. And he took a swallow and spat it out. And it came from literally a stupid little insult, or a prank, teenage prank, which is what you'd have called it, and ends up a guy dead.
It was a friend of Andrew Curran's, called Paul Brown, who had urinated into Zach Malavin's drink. Malavin would soon retaliate.
Now, as you can imagine, Zach Malavin wasn't very happy about this. So in reply, he stabbed Brown and Curran, then later tried to run Curran down in his car.
To prevent this turning into an ongoing feud, Curran's father, also called Andrew, arranged a meeting with the Malavins in Maryhill Park to sort things out.
His father, who is of an age who will know you don't mess with a big family like the Malavins, picked up the phone, made an approach and said, get the boys down to the park, we'll sort this out. We're not talking about what we call in Glasgow a square go, which is a no-weapons fight.
Yeah.
They weren't talking about that, they're talking about sitting down and just getting it sorted.
So why did they choose this then?
Because there's no CCTV. So you can sit in here at night, you can drink your drink, you can smoke your dope, you can party with your pals, have your music on, and nobody's really going to interfere with you.
Yeah.
And whatever you get up to, it's not on tape.
Both families agreed to meet here, Maryhill Park, on the evening of April the 16th. It culminated in a bloody and barbaric slaying that shocked the whole community.
In the 1930s, the rivalry between the Protestant and Catholic was played out on the football pitch, with the west of the town supporting Rangers and the east supporting Celtic.
In spite of the weather, we saw Celtic trying their skill against the Rangers. Celtic kicked off and run straight into the attack.
The Billy Boys used their loyalty to Rangers as a way of attacking Catholics.
Ill trouble breaking out on the terraces here.
They would infiltrate the Rangers fans to provoke battles with Celtic supporters.
Referee has stopped the match, as he would have to do, of course.
One of their many fights took place here on a train.
On the afternoon of the 3rd of March 1934, a group of about 500 Rangers supporters were gathered here at Bridgeton Station on their way to a match at Ibrox.
Andrew is taking me to the exact spot where they had all amassed. It's now a disused platform beneath the new station.
Oh, yeah, rather you than me.
This was the site of one of the Billy Boys' attacks, which would ultimately seal their fate.
Oh, I see.
It has become a shrine to the gang.
So we're walking now into what was part of the original Bridgeton Cross station, and you just look at the walls here, some of the kind of the legends told in the graffiti are taking you right back to the 1920s. The Derry Boys was basically the junior section of the Billy Boys.
Right.
So a young lad would join the Derry Boys first and then would be promoted, as he's probably in his late teens, promoted into the senior ranks of the Billy Boys.
So this is part of the original station where the famous attack happened?
That's right. The platform is packed with Rangers supporters, as many as 500 or 600 of them, decked out in blue scarves and rosettes. They're waiting for a train that's going to take them to Ibrox Park. Rangers are playing at home. But onto the platform arrives a train heading to Paisley that's carrying Celtic supporters to St Mirren. And as soon as the train grinds to a halt, the two sets of supporters begin hurling abuse at each other. There are all kinds of insults and threats being shouted. So the Rangers supporters are hurling abuse at the papists, as they call them, on the train. That abuse is given back in spades by the Celtic supporters. And then in the middle of this pandemonium on the platform, a group of Rangers supporters steps forward.
What followed was sectarian violence, but it was hidden amongst a football crowd and would pass off as an act of hooliganism. It started when one of the Billy Boys, a man called John Tracair, burst onto the train. It would typify football thuggery for decades to come. It would also bring about a war on gangs and the downfall of the Billy Boys.
Tracair set upon the first man he could find, a man called McVeigh, and Tracair tried to slash him across the face with a razor. But McVeigh shielded himself with his arm. Tracair then turned around and punched McVeigh's companion in the face.
The other passengers are desperate to get him off. The guard comes running down the train and helps to bundle Tracair back off onto to the platform. And then he's screaming at the driver to get the train out of there as quickly as possible.
Here are some of the weapons the Billy Boys used to carry. Knives, hatchets, hammers. And this is a razor, like the one used by Tracair in the attack.
It wasn't just a regular group of Rangers fans.
It wasn't. Tracair was very much associated with the Billy Boys. He had quite a record of taking part in sectarian gang fights in the East End. And what seems to have happened here is that a group of Billy Boys has planned this ambush, and they've used the much bigger group of Rangers supporters on the platform as a kind of cover or a cloak for their activity.
My story from 2010 is about the Maryhill Park. The Curran and the Malavin families arranged to meet and settle a dispute. Andrew Curran had initiated the meeting after an altercation involving a member of the Malavin family. So the Malavins and the Currans arranged to meet here.
Yep.
Just tell me what happened.
Andrew Curran and his pals turned up, in theory, expecting to sort of sort out a problem which was beginning to get out of hand. Might not all walk away friends, but we will all walk away from it, they thought. But the Malavins were never intending to do that, because they turned up with the shotgun, the knives, the machetes, etc. And young Curran turns up with his pals.
Malavins also brought backup. The two sides clashed. Andrew Curran Sr. was called on his mobile and, unarmed, ran to the park with his friend James McGregor to help. He tries to calm the situation, but the Malavins turn on him. They chase him across the park with a machete.
Talking about a man in his 40s, perhaps not his fist, getting chased across the park by presumably a mad, full of drugs or drink kid waving a 3-foot machete at you.
Andrew Curran Sr. was cornered and slashed in the stomach and the neck. Watch as his father clutched his throat as blood just poured from him.
And he's been pretty brutally dispatched.
He was attacked with a machete?
Machete, yeah, which is jungle stuff. It's horror book stuff.
Then Andrew Curran's friend, James McGregor, age 50, was chased and assaulted. He was slashed with a sword and shot in the body with a crossbow.
To me, it looked like the whole scenario was hijacked so that somebody could do something nasty to somebody. And the premise for it all was this: there's been a slight, there's been an insult, you've taken it too far, ever, with this bottle of pee.
So you think the two families had a problem before?
I think the Malibans had a problem with young Curran. Once you turn up in a park, one with a shotgun, one with a machete, two or three with knives, you're not there for any reason other than to inflict serious damage.
An ambulance was called. Andrew went with his father to hospital. He died the same day. Andrew Curran Sr. was unarmed, yet he was mercilessly stabbed to death in Maryhill Park. He was attacked with a machete after he'd gone to help his son calm a feud with the Malavim family.
It's believed Mr. Curran's 18-year-old son was in this area on Saturday night. He got into bother with the gang and his father, who lived just down the road, ran out to help him. It's believed the gang then turned on him and stabbed him.
He was a brave boy to turn up, and his dad did what any father would. You would do, I would do. Your kids, someone threatens your child, you're straight in there.
Yeah.
We wouldn't pick up a weapon, we'd pick up the phone and dial the police.
Yeah.
But in this sort of area or in this sort of situation, you don't have time to pick up the police. You cause more danger for your child if you do pick up the police, because you're a grass, your kids are grass, your whole family's marked by everybody by that point. So you do what you do, you go out the house and you try and calm it down.
In this tight-knit neighbourhood, no incident goes unnoticed.
Calls are made to the police. Police know exactly who's done it. The whole area knew who'd done it. I was at home within two phone calls, knew who'd done it. But it's getting the process of getting them into court, getting people to give evidence, getting witnesses assured that they will be safe. When the witnesses got to live in the heartland, next door to some of these people, or in the same close as we call it, the same tenement as their relatives, they've got to go to the same shops, go to the same chemists, pick up methadone from the same chemists, etc. I mean, that's the way it is up here.
But despite the intimidation, the perpetrators were charged and taken to court. The Malavim brothers, Angus, age 26, and Zach, just 17, along with a man named Stephen Suley, age 21, were brought to trial at the High Court in Glasgow. Brothers Zach and Angus were found guilty of the murder of 41-year-old Andrew Curran. Zach Malavim got 18 years, his brother, 17. Suley was found guilty of culpable homicide and received 7 years. All three men were also convicted of assaulting Mr. Curran's friend, James McGregor, by slashing him with a sword and shooting him with a crossbow, causing permanent disfigurement. But when the court was over, the violence began.
I mean, within hours of the trial finishing, there was intimidation, people were giving evidence. I mean, 4 hours after the guys were sent down, the brothers were sent down, there was a shotgun through a window. There was a guy get slashed in Maryhill Road, there's somebody else get threatened in their car. And that's before the family were even back from court. These people were genuinely innocent witnesses, in most cases, who got dragged into something they'd never experienced and then suddenly found themselves getting forced up whole sort of gangland scruples and morals, if you can call them that, where you don't speak, you don't deal, you don't get... You've seen a guy stabbed to death, or a neighbour you know, you've known for 20 or 30 years, gets murdered, and you know who's done it, and you're a decent person. You're going to speak up. But the idea that someone's going to come up 5 o'clock in the morning, some total coward, and put a double-barrel shotgun and fire 150 shells, 150 ball bearings through your window, and your kids are asleep, your grandkids are asleep.
Yeah, of course.
And you don't know when you walk out the door the next morning if they're waiting there. I wouldn't do it.
Further violence against the Curran family was soon to come.
This is Rothes Drive in Somerset. Just 1 month after the Malavim brothers were jailed, the victim's son, Andrew Curran, was attacked right here. He was stabbed several times in the head with a machete, just yards away from where his father was killed.
I wondered just how often attacks like this happen in Glasgow. In a single year, 2008-2009, assaults with a sharp object in the Glasgow region resulted in over 2,000 occupied bed days in hospital. That's 6 beds all year long containing the victims of blade attacks. have never come across anything like this before. This clan-like culture is so aggressive and violent, it's just totally alien. To try and grasp an understanding of it, I'm on my way to the Southern General Hospital to meet surgeon Dr. Christine Goodall.
Christine.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Martin.
Hi, Martin.
So you're an oral surgeon?
Yeah, that's right.
Just explain to me what that is.
Well, you would understand an oral surgeon probably as the person who takes out your wisdom teeth and does things like that. So a lot of what we do is dental, but we also deal with facial trauma, usually as a result of violence, usually young men, actually. And we have to deal with injuries that range from anything from just bruising from fist fights right up to very, very serious injuries that have been caused when people start using weapons.
What sort of injuries do you see with someone coming in here with a razor cut?
Well, what you would typically see is a big scar across the face, and oftentimes what people do is they'll slash somebody like that, so that's what you tend to get. That's not a good place to have a facial scar.
Why?
The easiest ones to repair are the ones that fit into the lines that everybody has on their face, so into those kind of sort of smile lines. If you have one right across your face, then that's always going to be quite obvious. And that's typically what you see from these injuries. The worst sort of those are the ones where maybe two razor blades or two Stanley blades have been stuck together on the back of a toothbrush, leaving a small gap in between. And that gives you a very difficult scar to repair because you have to take out the piece of tissue in the middle.
And then you have to pull it all together.
You have to put it all together, and you're left with a deficit of tissue then. And
why is that? Just explain to me, why can't you sew both
because
the lines?
It won't have enough of a blood supply to survive,
right.
So the bit in the middle, it would tend to die and fall away, and that would leave you with a bigger problem. So you're better to cut that bit out and stitch together what you've got. But it unfortunately leaves you quite a wide scar, and that's very difficult to hide later on.
Do you ever see someone coming in here with the Glasgow smile?
You do, occasionally do see it. More times than not, it would be one side and not both sides. The typical Glasgow smile is cut on both sides.
Yeah.
And that's very much a gang thing where somebody's been pinned down and that's been done to them. But oftentimes you would just maybe see one side and not the other, and it's a cut from the side of the mouth right up. And again, a very difficult wound to repair well.
Do you ever get someone coming in here who is kind of proud of their scars?
Yeah, we do. We do.
That must be so disheartening.
It is. I had a young lad quite a few years ago now who I saw in the middle of the night stitched up, and we kept him overnight in the hospital because he'd been drinking. And I went round to see him the next morning, and I said to him, look, I'm really sorry about this. It's a really bad injury. You're going to be left with a scar. You know, we can maybe in the fullness of time try and make it a bit less obvious, but it's never going to not be there. And he just said to me, oh, don't worry about it, hen. It's not a problem. And I thought, well, right, OK, that's a bit strange. And then all of his friends came to visit him in the afternoon, and they all had scars.
Yeah.
And actually, for him, that was his badge of honour.
Gangs wear scars like badges. They're like marks of honour. There seems something so viciously self-hating in the urge to destroy another person's appearance.
Why have they got to slash someone's face?
The booze and blades culture.
No, why can't they just punch someone?
Well, so one of them, I spoke to one about 20 years ago and said it's like the old, you know, have a duel, leave the man with a dueling scar thing. And I said, you see it? He said, well, that's what it was like. It's like Zorro time and like the Austrian sword fencing. So you leave a guy with a mark, so everyone knows I've tanned him. So next time you see him in the street, I've claimed you. And the guy's got a smile on his face. The Glasgow smile, which is the classic, up the sides.
I'm looking at a Glasgow gang called the Billy Boys, one of the largest and most organised gangs in the city's history.
After John Tricaire attacked a Celtic supporter on a train, the police started a manhunt. At 10:30 p.m, a man is charged with drunk and incapable behaviour and is taken into custody.
It took them 2 days to identify the man. Presumably, once he'd sobered up, they finally ID'd him as John Tricaire, the man who so brutally attacked John McVeigh on the train. He was charged with mobbing, assault, and rioting.
The trial of John Tricaire would be a turning point and came as a surprise to everyone. At that time, the law had been heavily biased towards Protestants. They'd often been treated leniently, but this time the judge showed no favours.
And Tricaire was found guilty.
Don Traquair then gets a really exemplary sentence. The judge sentences him to 4 years imprisonment.
How was that seen? Was that harsh?
It was really quite harsh, given the offence for which he'd been convicted, and there was quite a lot of uproar. There's a petition launched in protest against the severity of the sentence, and something around 40,000 people signed that, asking for a review of the sentence, that really, you know, protesting that jail term was far too long.
And was it changed?
It wasn't. The appeal went to the Secretary of State for Scotland, but he turned it down.
John Traquair may only have committed an assault, but it was what he represented that so frightened the authorities. Hundreds of fighting football fans could potentially be whipped up and used by the likes of Traquair and the Billy Boys for political means. To the authorities, the consequences were unthinkable. Destabilizing hundreds of football supporters could transform gang violence into full sectarian war. Viewed in isolation, this one incident, a random act of violence, may appear insignificant against the backdrop of Glasgow's history. But what terrified the authorities was the thought of what this scale of infiltration could become and the sectarian violence it could unleash. In line with this tougher stance, Glasgow's new chief of police was none other than gangbuster Percy Sillitoe.
He had done such wonderful work down in Sheffield, according to the stories. So they brought him up here over and above a local man. That caused some aggro locally. And he immediately set out on his own boot and baton policy to bring them into line.
Scores of big, hardy men were recruited from the Highlands and other rural areas, given basic training, a uniform, and told to get out and mix it.
Arrest and fine wasn't doing any good, so they were going to batter their way out of it. So basically fight fire with fire.
The 1,500-strong Glasgow police were the largest force in Britain outside London. They were called the biggest gang in the world, and the Billy Boys had now become their prime target. During the 1930s, the Billy Boys remained the most powerful gang in Glasgow. Marching behind their leader, Billy Fullerton, they set out to taunt the Catholic neighbourhoods.
The Billy Boys came marching down this street, Norman Street, flaming the Catholic locals with their music.
A large Catholic razor gang, known as the Norman Conks, who lived in this street, often prepared to retaliate when they heard the Billy Boys approaching.
The Norman Conks knew they were coming, heard they were coming because they weren't creeping up on them, and would ambush them. So from the windows, from roofs, if they could get onto them, they would attack them, throw missiles, throw bottles, throw dirt, anything at all, human waste. And then down in the street, there would be a battle royal going on.
But by 1935, the Glasgow police, now under the command of gangbuster Percy Sillitoe, set out to ambush the gangs.
Police mounted a charge led by Sillitoe's Cossacks, as his force were known. It was the beginning of the end for the Billy Boys.
Sillitoe ordered the mounted police to Celtic Park, together with two large covered vans filled with policemen. They hid down a side street. There they waited.
But they were clever with it. They didn't wade in at the height of battle. They waited until both sides had more or less worn each other out, and then the police would come in and mop it up in a far more ferocious way on occasion.
As the Billy Boys band entered Norman Street, the order to charge was given.
This road here became littered with casualties. The police had broken up the parade, scoring an historic victory. According to Sillitoe, only one of the Billy Boys escaped without injury. It was Elijah Cooper, the big drum player, who hid in his drum until he could surrender peacefully.
But that wasn't necessarily what broke the gangs in the end. It was his intelligence-gathering techniques. It was other things that he did. It wasn't just the violence. It wasn't the Untouchables. It wasn't the Sillitoe's Cossacks, as the Mounties became to be called. Right. It was the whole package. He brought in all sorts of revolutionary new ideas to the Glasgow police force. Everything came together and helped bring the gangs down. Didn't destroy them, didn't wipe them out, but it certainly brought them down a peg or two.
Billy Fullerton was sent to prison, and while he was inside, Sillitoe was able to inflict the most damage by seizing the Billy Boy's bank account. There, he found £600 stashed away to pay the gang's court and legal expenses. It would spell the end of the Billy Boys, but Fullerton's extreme prejudices would soon find new outlets.
When he came out, Billy Fullerton created a 200-strong band of Mosley's Blackshirts until the fascist leader was interned. Later, Fullerton formed Glasgow's own branch of the Ku Klux Klan. As well as despising people of colour, the KKK was also anti-Semitic and anti-Catholic.
Billy Fullerton died in poverty in 1962, aged 57, in a single-room tenement home in Brook Street, just to the north of Brigton Cross. He was given a spectacular send-off, including flute bands, as around 1,000 marched in his funeral cortege from Brigton Cross to the cemetery at Ridley in the northeast of Glasgow. There he is buried in an unmarked grave.
So where do we go from here? Where's the Percy Sillitoe of the 21st century? Well, let me tell you, it's right here. Strathclyde's Violence Reduction Unit.
I'm about to meet Karen McCluskey. She's a director of this unit, which she set up in 2008. She's responsible for bringing about a radical new approach in tackling gangs. She did what no one had ever dared do before. She hauled in all the gangs and laid down the law to them.
We wanted to try and make a big change because you can't just take 10 people. Mm. It has to be about hundreds to achieve a real big shift in gangs.
So how'd you do that?
We had to get the parents, we had to get the schools, we had to convince them to come in. And we had the most fantastic sheriffs down in the court. And they pretty much let us have the court. And we had a sitting sheriff. And we got all the guys in. And we had 120 in the morning and then another 100 in the afternoon. And the chief would stand up.
So you were putting rival gangs in the same room?
All of them, all of them. I mean, this was about, you know, this was... It's a really risky strategy. I mean, I think when we started, I thought it'd be catastrophic or it'd be really successful. You know, these guys having weapons, we had to search them at the front door. We had a whole range of things in place. And we got them in the courtroom. And the chief stood up and we flashed their pictures around the room. Mm. And we said, we know who you are, we know where you live. And he said, I'm so powerful, I can have them all outside your front door if I so wish, my corps. You know, I can make your life really difficult. It's not hard, you know, but we want you to stop. We want you to stop this because I don't want to go and see your parents and tell them that you're dead or they're coming to arrest you for a murder.
So you came down hard on them. This is approach.
The chief was... I mean, this is about hard enforcement. It's about the community. And it's also about... But it's about making a promise, make a choice. And then we get a sergeant to stand up and he says, you boys might not know what you're doing, but let me tell you what I get in my surgery. And he shows them the pictures. And some of them are really graphic, but that's what he says, you know. I mean, we have some of the worst cases of facial injury anywhere in the world here. And you can see it, and they're looking away, you know. So they've gone from that chest out, you know, and come ahead to they're looking away. They cannot look at it. And we offered a few fainters. And then I suppose the best and the worst part is we get a mum to stand up. And it is just... Unless you'd seen it, it's very difficult to explain.
I can imagine.
She stands up and she says, you boys might not care about yourself, but here's what happened to my son when I cradled him when he died. And I go into his room every single day and I will never get over it. It's destroyed my husband, it's destroyed my family, and I cared about my son. And you know, and you could hear a pin drop in the courtroom.
I know, exactly.
And
you can hear them
sobbing in the back. Because regardless of how beleaguered some of these families are, they love their mothers.
Yeah.
And it's the most powerful thing ever. And we then say, make a choice. You can make a choice here. And the really interesting thing is, for lots of the people that we deal with, they've got no choice about where they're born, what parents are born to, what school they go to, even what gang they go into. This sometimes is the first time in their life that they've had a choice. And it is amazing how many of them stand up in the court and say, I want out.
Everything I've seen and learnt in this city is like no place I've ever experienced before. No matter what the area, there are gangs. But it's not just the gangs. Here it's a whole deep-rooted mentality that goes with it. You have to admire the work that Karen is doing, but I wonder if it can ever eradicate the hatred, the bitterness, the violence, which has become so ingrained here, it's like a life force of its own.
So what's the future hold for Glasgow's gangs?
Well, I think they're turning the corner. I mean, what we realise now is young people live in the OK and hello culture. They want to look good.
Yeah.
They want to, you know, they want to be... They're conscious about their appearance. If you get a scar on your face, you'll not get the job you want, you'll not get, you know, you'll not get the girlfriend you want, you know. It will affect you for the rest of your life. And I think sometimes when the medic's going in, I think the kids are starting to see it, you know. They talk about alcohol, they talk about the sugar concentration in alcohol and say to the girls, look, you put on loads of weight, you know, you're not, it's no good in Lycra. And, you know, but these are the things that motivate people to change yeah. their behaviour, and that's what we want. We want them to step away from, you know, from doing the violence and to be brave enough and to have enough resilience to say, I don't want to be part of the gang.
So what are the results?
Well, we've had a 50% reduction in our, you know, in wow. our offending, our gang our violence. So, you know, I think it's probably exciting times, but it's resilience you need. This is a long term. It's been here since, for 100 years.
Yeah.
120 years. So you need to be pretty exceptional to try and drive it out.
I tell you, I can't... I'm shocked at what I've just seen in there. Karen off camera showed us some CCTV footage of some gang violence, but real gang violence. It kind of hit home what this show's all about. It was just sickening to see kids acting like that. And it's places like this that are working towards kind of fixing the problem. I'm still not convinced that it's a problem that can be fixed. I think it goes a lot deeper down than just the one gang, you know, trying to take knives away. Or I think it's ingrained, the problem. Listen, we can only hope.
With a straightforward murder inquiry costing £1.3 million and a year in prison working out at £49,000, this unit doesn't have to prevent many killings to become worthwhile. Since 2008, nearly 500 gang members from eastern Glasgow have engaged in the violence reduction scheme. As a result, violent offending has fallen by 46%, weapon possession has dropped by 85%. And involvement in gang fighting down by 73%. Glasgow is no longer the murder capital of Western Europe.